Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Where, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. This week, I'm speaking with Susie Batiz, the founder of two incredible household brands. Susie started her career in a tough spot. She filed her first bankruptcy at the age of 20 and subsequently bounced between 27 different career paths, everything from owning tanning salons to selling rebuilt computers to recruiting. She even got to the final stages in founding a website that matched a company's culture to the culture preferences of a potential employee. But then the dot-com bubble burst and she lost everything again. But eventually, Susie did build a brand, a hugely successful one at that, in an unexpected category. In 2007, after 9 months of testing with aromatherapy oils, she launched the Before You Go to the Bathroom spray, Poo-Pourri. Today, the brand is sold in 40,000 retailer doors around the world. In 2018, Susie used aromatherapy oils once again to create another game-changing brand called Supernatural. The line of all-natural cleaning products uses concentrates and sustainable packaging for the lowest carbon footprint, all while reducing the consumer's exposure to harmful chemicals. Between both brands, Susie has built an empire valued at over $500 million and, according to Forbes, is one of the richest self-made women in America. Needless to say, Susie's career journey has been quite the wild ride, filled with highs and lows, and I can't wait to share her resilient path to founding not one, but two innovative brands. Now, on Second Life, it's Susie Batiz. So we always like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So I'm hoping that you can tell me, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
It's really funny. You know, I grew up in a pretty dysfunctional environment. So I didn't really have a lot of dreams, you know, that most kids have. It was more about kind of me surviving. I dropped the word kind of. I always made like my own Barbie clothes, and I made my own clothing up until I got my first job at 15, so that I could buy clothing, right? But I always made my own clothes. So looking back, I would have wanted to be a clothing designer, but I grew up in a little small town in Arkansas, and I didn't even know that was a possibility. So when I went to college, there was nothing even remotely close to that. Like, I didn't even know, you know, that was an option. I just grew up pretty naive, and I didn't have parents that would help me investigate anything. So I first became an accounting major and then realized, oh, that's not going to work after a semester. Then I became a psychology major, and the psychology professor told me I'm never going to make it because I'm going to spend more time on the couch than I would helping people.
Oh, that's fabulous.
I'm an empath. And then I ended up being a marketing major, but then I dropped out before I ever took a marketing class. So
got it.
It was that kind of road. Yeah. But looking back, I created my first design when I was 17. I designed a pair of shoes, denim pumps, And my boyfriend at the time's aunt worked at a shoe factory. And I drew them out, got some jeans and leather, and had her make these denim pumps because I knew they would match my, you know, match my jeans. So I made these shoes, and I called guests in New York and said, I've made these shoes. Yeah, never thought about it as a business. I just wanted to tell them, like, I made these shoes. And they said, well, come see me. And I'm like, wow. So I go to my mother, and I'm like, guest wants to see me in New York because they're starting a shoe line. And she said, you can't go to New York City. And I said, why? And she said, you're just a little girl from Arkansas. They're going to chew you up and spit you out. And I never went. But looking back, you know, it's like I would have wanted to be like a clothing and shoe designer.
It's so interesting how in retrospect, we can see some of like the little formation or little foundations of stuff that interests us still as adults, which is why whenever for whatever reason, my high school has been really sweet about asking me to come back and speak to the students a number of times. And I always tell them, I'm like, whatever it is that you get in trouble for, that's a thing that you can do when you grow up. And I'm not talking about like boys or drugs or beer or whatever, but like the thing that your parents get mad at you for spending too much time doing. For me, in my case, it was that I was always reading magazines and collecting magazines. And it's so funny because I ended up working for Elle Magazine, and that was sort of like my be all end all. But I was much like you. I think it's also partially generational. Like we grew up before internet. So I didn't really have a sense of what was possible, that there were, it didn't even dawn on me to think about journalism until I was well into college because we didn't know any journalists. There were limited ideas, I think, at that point in time. So we have some similarity in that sense. Sounds like you started working early though.
I did. I my first job was at Burger King. I was 15. I lied to them and told them I was 16 just so I could get a job. Back then, you didn't have to show a driver's license.
That's kind of crazy. So you started working at a young age. What was your first job that you think of as like your first proper job, and how did you get it?
Well, when I was a senior in high school, I was a manager of Tempo Fashions, and it was like a Ross, like a big store. I was the youngest store manager in the company.
You were a senior in high school? That's crazy.
I know.
How did you get that job?
I started off working as an associate, and, you know, I think because I did grow up pretty poor, I'm very resourceful. And I just sort of always had this hustle in me. And I just got promoted like really fast, like in 3 months or something.
Wow. That's amazing. What did your day-to-day look like when you were doing that? And how were you fitting school in?
I know. So that was at the end of when I was a senior. So I was just going to school. I think you got out at 2 back then. And then I would just go in and work all night, you know, from 2 to 10. And I get home back at 11 and go back to school the next day. And then, of course, all my whole summer was taken up with that. And when I started college, one of the reasons I dropped out of college is because I was working full time. And then I got married at 19 to get out of the house. And I bought a bridal salon. So then I hopped over to being an entrepreneur at 19.
Okay, let's talk about that. So why a bridal salon? And where did you come up with the money to do that?
Yeah, it's really funny. My husband, that we were married for a year, I just knew, I thought money was going to get me out of the situation I was in always. I was always looking for something. And this bridal salon was for sale. It was a really older lady. She ended up selling me really old inventory. I ended up going bankrupt in like a year. So I always say it's like those rodeo riders, you know, that the gate opens and they just fall flat on their face. So I was married, bankrupt, and divorced by the time I was 20 years old.
Oh, like, my goodness.
How does that happen? I was barely out of puberty.
You know? Oh, my goodness. So what was that experience like, and what did you learn from it, and what did you carry forward from going through such a crazy experience at such a young age?
Yeah. So the banker that I was with, my stepfather, knew the banker. So I went into the banker and I asked him for more money, to borrow more money. And he taught me a couple of things. He said, the number one thing in business is to recognize when you have a dead fish. And when you have a dead fish, you need to throw it overboard, and you do not, you know, just turn around and don't look back. And he was like, you have a dead fish. You know, like, I'm not giving you any money. So that was really good. Like, basically cut your losses fast, right? So I did learn that. And another thing he said, I was talking to him. I said, well, at least I got experience, right? And that's the best teacher. And he said, no, it's not, but fools will learn no other way. And ooh, those, isn't that amazing? But those two things have always stuck with me. Like, really, get out really quick, call your losses really quick. And you don't always have to have experience. You can actually learn through wisdom.
I like that. I know, because I often talk about the fact that I wish I was the sort of person who learned through wisdom, but I tend to have to experience things myself. Not always, but oftentimes, like, to get a lesson to really stick, it seems to be through falling on my face.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I used to be that way. Hopefully I've changed that. But
But
and my mentor, Gay Hendrick, says it's better to learn through wisdom than experience. So
I like
that's
that.
A mantra that I have. Yeah, I commit to learning through wisdom rather than experience.
I like that. Here for that. So you had a number of jobs then after that. I'm doing a lot of things in the sales world, everything from, I read you were selling items out of your own car to owning tanning salons. I'm hoping that you can walk me through a little bit about what that time in your life was like and what was the end goal, or if you even knew what that was.
I just made a list, and I think it was 27 different jobs and things that I've done.
Wow.
So I know it was a lot. I was always hustling. So even if I had a job, I always had a side hustle. Like I was selling something out of, I was buying something and then selling it, you know, marking it up and going and selling it to a tanning salon or a beauty salon. So I was, you know, I would buy things and sell them at garage sales. It's really funny. One of the jobs I listed was garage sale professional. Because, you know, like I could find something, you know, like, for example, my ex-husband worked at a company and they were selling computers for $100. The old decommissioned computers, and this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but we would buy them and he would come home and redo them. Then we'd sell them on the weekend at a garage sale for like $300, right? Mm-hmm. So I was always really good at spinning things and turning things. And I've had clothing salon, tanning salon, bridal salon. I was a recruiter. You know, I just always had a hustle going, like always, because I really thought money was going to get me out. And I thought it was going to bring me happiness. Ultimately, it didn't. I found that after my second bankruptcy. But I was always, I really thought, you know, one day I'm going to make it somehow.
And did you know what making it looked like to you? Was it a specific career, or was it a specific number in the bank, or was it something tangible? It was a feeling, a vibe.
It's just a feeling and a vibe, you know. It's really funny. I still don't even have that. You know, when I got listed in Forbes, I laid down and cried for like 4 hours, and my family kept calling and they said, why, what's going on? And I said, have you ever seen those people that ran the long distance, you know, the marathons, yeah, and they collapse over the finish line?
Yeah.
And I go, that's what the feeling I have. But the weird thing is, I didn't even know I was in a race. I didn't even consciously know, but there was some sort of validation within myself. I didn't even know the list existed when they called me. But there was some sort of internal validation that happened.
That's like, interesting.
I finished some sort of a race or something.
And you didn't even know you were running it.
I didn't even know I was running it. No, isn't that wild?
That is pretty wild. So what did you do next?
In between all that time, I was in an abusive marriage and escaped that. And then ended up with my third husband, who was a musician. And we just had businesses all on the side. I had a tanning bed repair business. I had a hot tub repair business. So I was working in retail then. I was a district manager for some retail stores. And I would have these businesses on the side. But then I had my final big breakdown at 38. I was in the final stages of getting $5 million in funding for an idea that I had called Greener Grass. And it was a recruiting platform that matched a company's culture to a person's culture. Now, this was
That's so
20
ahead
years,
of its time.
It was 20 years ahead of the time. We're just now talking about culture, but I mean, just knew that was the most important thing.
So it was matching company culture with
to a person's culture.
A person's preferences and cultures.
And then you would go down into technical match.
I mean, but like, I feel like even when I started my career, no one was talking about culture. Like, this is so incredibly ahead of its time. Where did you come up with the idea and how did that go?
Well, I was recruiting. I was the vice president of a recruiting firm, and then I started consulting for like Ernst & Young. And what I realized was that people were focused on technical matches. And mm-hmm. what I realized is that it was really, I was looking for a cultural match, because that was going to be the longest term match, because, you know, you had to guarantee that the person would last a year. So I just right. intuitively knew that it was culture. So I, you know, had psychologists on board. And back then, I don't even know if there were any personality tests. There weren't very many. So we were designing our own personality test. And I put all of our money that we had in it. We were already living, you know, typical Western life of the big house that was mortgaged, the cars that were mortgaged. And I was in the final stages. I was going to get $5 million of funding, which this was in 2000. So it was a lot of money. And the stock market crashed. And that was in 2001. And I literally lost everything after that. It all was like a house of cards. This all came tumbling down.
How did that change things?
Oh, my God. I was pretty done. My background's pretty varied, as you'll see. I tried to kill myself when I was 21 because, I mean, I had a really rough life. And I was like, who wants to do this life? And I felt the same way when I was, after this happened, like literally, like I had nothing left. So I had that proverbial moment of getting on your knees and just saying, I'm done with this life. I had children, so I wouldn't kill myself, but I was pretty done. I mean, just had all this rage and anger because I tried so hard. You know, it wasn't like I didn't put forth effort. Like I really busted it. I laugh about hustling, but that's all I did was hustle.
I mean, that is a lot. I can only imagine too that like the experience of going through bankruptcy at that point in your life had to have been a lot more difficult than the first time around. And I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about how you pulled yourself through that and were able to move forward.
Yeah, it was really, really bad. And I often say, if I'm speaking about this on stage, is like, I was in such a bad place that I lied to everyone. And I even lied to my children. So imagine lying to the people that love you the most and unconditionally, right? So I hid everything because no way could people know that I'm a failure. So I just lied my way out of it for a while. And I was like, oh, we have to move, you know, your dad closer to your dad's work. And I would tell everyone, oh, yeah, we need to move closer to downtown. We didn't like those cars, so we got other cars. I mean, I just lied my way out of everything. Mm-hmm. And I became really severely depressed, like, you know, because you can't do all that stuff and get away with it forever. Eventually it starts building up.
Yeah, it's toxic. And,
yeah, it's very toxic. So I went to a hypnotherapist and I said, you know, hey, I'm in a mess here. And he said, your problem is you have no meaning in your life. I'm like, what are you talking about? I literally said, I have kids. Like, what do you mean I don't have any meaning? And he said, nah, like you don't have any meaning. So he gave me a book by Viktor Frankl called Man's Search for Meaning. And have you read that?
I've read it, yes.
Yeah. And I just sort of had a head tilt, like, huh, what did I didn't have anything to grab onto. I really didn't. So I didn't have any form of spirituality, and I really didn't have anything to hold on to other than my family, which was still a lot to hold on to, but at that point, you know, I wasn't even conscious enough to realize the gift that they were. You know, right. I was in my own drama. And then I started studying like Buddhism and Hinduism and Kabbalah. You know, wore the red string for a while and went to Kabbalah lessons because Madonna did it. Yeah. And I was searching, you know, I was really searching. And then finally I went to a workshop from Byron Katie, and I went in drinking like a double thing of Yellowtail a night, like a bottle of wine, and came out, and I was sober for 10 years and was happy for the first time in my life. Like, wow. True, I found peace and happiness within my being. And the ironic thing is I didn't need money. I knew what wealth was. So it was the first time in my life that I wasn't running towards something. I was just happy. You know, my husband at the time made a decent living. You know, we were definitely middle income. We weren't, you know, rich by any stretch, but we had enough, you know, to buy food and, you know, groceries and I just really had no desire, zero desire to get back into business, zero desire for money. Like, I knew what wealth was for the first time in my life.
Quite a turning point.
Oh, it was massive. Yeah, it's everything. Everything changed.
So how did you end up getting back into business then after such a reset? And was it different now that you were coming from a different place?
Completely, completely different. In that I had no desire for business. It wasn't even a thought process of myself. I actually was doing a little life coaching almost. People would come over and just, I was talking to them about how to clear their mind and their space and their hearts and really teaching people presence. And I was at a dinner party and I had a family member that asked, could bathroom odor be trapped? They were talking about there was one bathroom in this house. And seriously, and I remember like the zing at my arm and this feeling. And I've always been kind of a hippie and I've done aromatherapy forever. And I just literally said, I can do that with oils. And they were like, what? And I was like, no, I can make that with oils. So it took me 9 months of really mixing and, you know, researching and mixing and researching and mixing it. Everybody thought I was crazy. Not one single person in my life thought it was a good idea. But I just knew I could do it. It was just a challenge. Still did never thought about being a business.
Did you have a name? Did you have a business plan? Did you have anything to invest in it? No ideas.
No idea.
You were just going to solve this problem.
I was going to solve the problem. And, you know, I was harassing my neighbors and my family, you know, like, do you got to go number two? And they were like, why? Because I can only test so often, right?
Right.
So I had to have like real tests. I mean, this is serious. And my husband at the time would just come out. I mean, he was really mad at me because the house smelled like oils. He was so tired of testing. And one day he walks out of the bathroom. I'll never forget. He's holding the bottle right up by his ear. And he goes, oh, my God, we're going to be millionaires.
Wow.
And I'm like, what do you mean? And he goes, do you know what you've done? You've literally just taken the smell out of shit. Those were his exact words. And I was like, what? Like in denial. Like, what do you mean? And he said, go in there. And I went in there. And I'm like, oh, my God. So then I still didn't believe it. I sent it up to 10 friends. And those friends were like, this is amazing. And it's fit similar to birthing a child in my experience in that, you know, you may accidentally get pregnant and then all of a sudden you have this being that you're going to take care of and you're completely devoted and committed to it. That was very much what happened with Poo-Pourri. I just happened to create it and it was so good that I couldn't keep it to myself.
That's incredible.
And at that point, I was like, oh, like this is going to be a business.
Interesting. So did you approach it differently at that stage than you had approached your previous businesses now that you had both experience and a little wisdom under your belt?
Oh, yeah. Completely different in that I started with $25,000 between my brother-in-law and I and about 1,000 bottles. And I was like, that's a lot. And the manufacturer needed 10,000, but they offered to do it with me for 1,000 to make me 1,000. And I thought, well, hell, I'll sell them out of the trunk of my car if I have to, because I've got experience doing that, right? So I bought 1,000 bottles, built a website, and someone, you know, said, I have a friend that sells retail, has a retail store. Will you sell to them? And I didn't know anything about it. So I doubled my prices so I could half them for wholesale. Because I was selling them for $5 and I was like, oh shit, like they want to buy it for $5, then I don't have enough margins here. So I doubled it and sold my first store. And then someone called the next day and said, hey, my friend Harold bought product. Can I buy it? And I'm like, sure. My second store. And then the third day, another store called. So it literally kept going word of mouth like that.
That's crazy. So what was that initial assortment? It was 1,000 bottles. Was it one all formulation?
One SKU.
Yeah. Okay.
I had one SKU for probably the first 2 years, single SKU, 2 ounce Poo-Pourri. That was it.
And okay, so you figured out your margins pretty quickly. How long did you keep them at that level? When did you think, okay, like now I need to start changing things? And where were you making all of this?
Yeah, so it was all made in the States, and I actually used back then stock bottles. So this is a lot of times people, they'll start companies, and they'll say they need all this funding, and they need, I'm like, oh my God.
Custom this and custom that.
Like, you have an idea, like, stop it. You know, get a dang bottle, decorate it, make it look good, and at least start proving whether you have something, right?
Right, right.
Then you can get into all your custom. We just now have a custom bottle, and I think that was 3 years ago when the company's 14 years old. So what I knew, though, I was smart enough to know that if I bought stock and materials, and I actually bought the first stock from my first bottles from McKernan, which stocked millions of these 2 ounce bottles on hand. So they were like my inventory, right? So they were holding these raw goods, and I could put POs in with them and keep my stock rotating. And my first Christmas, I asked my manufacturer to help me get through Christmas. And, you know, I couldn't afford to buy inventory. I asked them, could they give me 90 or 120 days? And they ended up saying, how about you just get the bottles and sprayers here and labels, and we'll fill them all, and we won't charge you until you have sold it. So they ended up partnering with me almost.
Wow.
But that's what I really love to get across to entrepreneurs is money doesn't help everything. And it usually doesn't. Like, just get smart and resourceful, you know,
right.
Start figuring shit out.
Catherine and I often think about this or talk about this. Like, we started our company in October 2006. And then, you know, to have digital content with an advertising-based model, and then immediately the recession hit and digital budgets were the first things to go. And then all of a sudden, when it's like we didn't have a lot of money, and then all of a sudden the money did dry up, it's like, okay, well, now is the time to get really creative. We didn't have an advertising budget. We didn't have a marketing budget. We had to figure out how to do it on our own and to do it virally. And it's really, I think, a gift in some ways to be underfunded. It can be a problem in others, for sure. But when you have to really figure things out with limited means, it can lead to great creativity.
It does. You know, you want a book that someone should read. It's Robert Rodriguez, the director, wrote a book. And I forget what the name of it is, but it's basically about how he makes movies on such low budget because you're actually more creative and more resourceful. So I own, between me and my family, I own 97% of the stock, and I have family members that own 3%. So we own 100% of the company still.
Wow.
And I have no debt and no investors. So
that's amazing.
The way I did it differently was zero debt. Like, I was like not willing to go in debt. We live very, very minimal for many, many, I'm talking the first 10 years of the company.
So all of the profit just went back into the company?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Launch goes very well. Word of mouth starts going. And then what happened next? At what point? So you have your website. Every day someone's calling, asking for more. At what point did you realize, okay, like, A, I have something on my hands, and B, a moment when you realized, okay, I'm going to have to take this to the next level?
Yeah, so probably about 3 months in, when I already was selling to multiple stores, it was, you know, really going, you know, word of mouth. And the interesting thing was, my partner at the time, my brother-in-law, wanted to go different directions. He thought we needed to slow down. And I'm like, I've been doing this shit for my whole life. Like, this is the time to put the gas on. Like, we need to do the opposite of slowing down, right? He thought we were growing too fast. And we ended up parting ways 6 months in. I bought him out. And I did $1 million the first year. And this was, and I built the company, this was in 2007. I built the company during the recession.
Wow.
Of 2008 as well. So I did $1 million the first year at a $5 bottle, you know, wholesale. So I was selling a lot of inventory. And I just knew, like, it was, everything was like, we got to go. Like, I just got to go.
Like, if you're moving it like that in the middle of a recession, that really says something.
Yeah. And, you know, well, I tell entrepreneurs all the time, like, don't stop at good. We have enough good products on the market. Make it great. Because when it's great, people tell other people about it.
They sure do. And that word of mouth is amazing. Speaking of which, let's talk about marketing. So because it's an interesting product and obviously revolves around a topic that can be somewhat taboo, what was your marketing strategy, and how would you say the product was received in the beginning? I mean, obviously people were buying it.
Well, I knew based on the way my neighbors and family members treated me when I was inventing it that people did not want to talk about bathroom odor. Like, I literally, they would look at me like I had four heads and was in a circus. They were just like, what? I mean, people with their body language, like they would back up, like, you're doing what?
Like literally, you know? Recoil.
Literally. And so I knew with that I had to have, I knew it was a taboo topic. Even though I didn't think it was so taboo, everybody did by their reaction. I knew it had to be funny. I looked at, you know, different ads that just naturally knowing if you talk about periods, you know, of course, this was 15 years ago, but, you know, if you make some sort of joke about it, or even in a family gathering, if you talk about farting, everybody laughs, that I knew it had to be funny, right? And that would help break the ice of it being a taboo product. I also knew it had to be pretty, because I was like, I'm talking about a subject that is not pretty. And I would have really pretty girls, you know, really dressed nice in our booth, because I knew, like, if you walk up and, you know, you're wearing sweats and you haven't done your hair in 3 days, and you're going, I want to talk to you about bathroom odor, I got to talk about poopery, people are like, what? But if you're dressed really nice, you know, and you want to talk about bathroom odor, people were more
receptive.
As receptive as possible. People still weren't interested. But what they did is I started giving out samples, and I would tell people, just try it. Just try it. And then you'll be back tomorrow to buy it. This was when I was at market. And they would come back the next day and they would say, that stuff works. I'm like, I know. So that's how I started selling it.
Got it. How did you come up with the name?
So we had been thinking of names for a long time. And, you know, it was like I told my family and friends, because everybody loved it by then. They were making it, you know, and everybody's calling me every day with ideas. And my sister-in-law calls and she says, poo poo paree, you know, like hip hip hooray. I had an interior design company at the time. I was with a client and I looked at her and I said, she just said poo poo paree, but poo paree, doesn't that sound like potpourri? And her and I together were like, that is the name. Like, I just knew it. And yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about building your team during this time.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's really funny. I was laying on the beach in Maui, and I don't remember if I was 5 years in or 7 years in, but I would read Harvard Business, you know, review articles.
Yep.
And I'm laying on the beach, and it says, you know, you're 5 years old. You've hired friends and family and anybody that would work cheap. And now you need to, you know, grow up in your business. And I was like, oh, I'm 5 years old. I've hired anybody that would work cheap. And I need smarter people, you know? So it's,
I feel seen.
Yeah. Part of it's like, I hate to be so predictable, you know? It's like, ah, shit. But then I was like, that's me. That's exactly what's happened. So, you know, with any business that's growing and scaling quickly, I think it's really hard. I think there's a myth that you have to retain people long-term, because the same people that you have at $1 million a year are not the same talent that you have at 100 million. You know, I mean, generally speaking, they're not going to be doing those same roles because you don't have the money at the beginning. It's been quite a challenge as we keep growing and scaling, but it's kind of funny. We always feel like Dorothy at the end of the day, you know, like we had it all along. You know, we'll bring in these big dogs and think, oh, they know about XYZ. They're going to know more than us. And then we're always going, no, they don't. Nope.
I have had such a similar experience where it's, you know, we've 14 years in, you know, you have these moments where you want to be humble and you want to think like this outside person,
yes,
look at their resume, look at their accolades, like they're going to know exactly what to do in this way or this way. But at the end of the day, like, I don't know what it is. It's just like when it's yours and it's sort of like there are a handful of people that we've worked with for a very long time, ultimately they just understand the DNA and the spirit of it in a different way.
100%. Yeah.
That's so interesting to hear you say that. Yeah. It's funny.
And we do have we have quite a few people, like my second employee still works there, and we've got a few old timers. It's really fun.
How would you describe your management style?
Oh God, I had an astrology reading the other day. Someone gifted me, and she said, "You're independent. You value freedom over love." I'm like, "I do." And she said, I bet your kids are very independent." I'm like, "They are." And she said, "I bet your employees have to be independent." I'm like, "They have to be." So my management style is, I've hired you to be the expert. You need to tell me what needs to happen.
Yeah.
I'll have the big vision. I'll be pushing us along, but you need to really let me know what needs to go on here.
So the opposite of a micromanager.
It's the opposite, except when it comes to branding. I will tell you, I'm very meticulous about how brands look. Our branding guide for Poo-Pourri is 65 pages long. We have a look, we have a voice, we have a tone, and I micromanage that into existence. And now it lives on its own. And it's amazing. We just went with some new email people, and their emails are like 85% on brand. And the reason is because we have such an in-depth brand guide. If people are listening, buckle down, get your brand guide, get your voice. What does it speak like? What is it? What would it do in this situation? What does it look like? Like down to the fonts, down to this is how the logo's used. This is what Poo-Pourri would say. This is what Poo-Pourri wouldn't say. Like down to this is what our Instagram looks like. It's very meticulous, but it's so easy for somebody to come in and go, okay, got it.
Yeah.
There's reference points.
It's your Bible. So in 2018, you evolved again and started Supernatural.
Yeah.
Can you explain that concept and how you came up with the idea?
Yeah. So my mom had passed away a few years before of a disease called MDS. And they told me at MD Anderson that it's 100% caused by chemical exposure.
Wow.
And she was a stay-at-home housewife, and it's caused by benzene. And benzene is in mothballs, it's in a lot of cleaning products, it's in cigarettes, it's in the lining of Coke cans and aluminum cans. And I was always talking to my mom about the cleaning products that she used, and I just had time just to go, what is going on here? And then at that same time, someone had come and tried to sell me a bottle that the top sustainable brand had. And because it sprayed upside down, it sprayed 360 degrees. And with Poo-Pourri, it's like any sprayer, it's hard to do that. And they wanted me to buy the sprayer. And I looked at it, and it had twice as much plastic because it had a vacuum fill on the inside. And I said, well, this has twice as much plastic. And they're like, yeah. I go, but it's recyclable. And they go, no. And I said, what? And I said, well, where's it filled? And they said, in Amsterdam. And I said, you mean to tell me that the top sustainable company in the world is buying a bottle that has twice as much plastic that's not recyclable, they're filling in Amsterdam, shipping out of here so that I can spray this air freshener upside down? Mm. And they said, yes. And I was like, what's wrong with this industry? So I spent 2 years and over $2 million developing Supernatural. Wow. I knew it had to be concentrates. I knew it had to have the lowest carbon footprint that I could make happen. And I knew that it had to be 100% natural and work better than the chemical competition. So it was hard, but I did it.
What was the hardest part about figuring out the assortment?
The hardest part was really to get natural products that work as good as chemicals.
Yeah.
You know, because chemicals strip, they clean. You know, the at what cost, right? You know, everyone right now is like disinfecting their homes like crazy. I'm like, oh my gosh, don't do that. You know, use colloidal silver. You know, there's lots of things you can do that doesn't harm your family. But it took a long time to get. And the difference is I use oils to do a job. So like the wood floor cleaner has fir oil in it. It actually conditions the wood. Some people are like, the scents are insane. But I don't use oils to smell good. I use oils to do a job. It just happens to smell good because you're using all essential oils.
A positive benefit. So you said $2 million in 2 years of research to get everything sorted. So that's quite a difference from launching Poo-Pourri. So when you started out with Supernatural, how did you frame it to yourself? Did you assign it a dollar amount and say, I'm going to give myself this budget, and if I don't figure it out, that's it? Were you interested in raising money? What was your process like?
If somebody had said, do you want to spend $2 million creating a brand? I would have said, hell no, right? But But it's just like I just kept getting in deeper waters. And I remember I worked for 9 months trying to solve the problem of poopery. I can get be like a dog on a bone. I really wanted to solve this issue.
Yeah.
And I got a little obsessed. And then whenever I created it, originally the name was Poof, P-O-O-F. And when the formulation started coming back and they smelled so beautiful and insane, I was like, this is not the name of this product. Like, it's too rich, you know? And I kept telling people, it's not natural, it's supernatural. Do you get it? Like, it's more than natural. Like, it is beyond. That's how I came up with the name Supernatural. But it's just, it was an evolution, an expensive evolution. I'm really proud of the brand. I'm really proud of it.
So how much was built through wisdom and how much was built through experience this time around?
A lot was built through wisdom. You know, what I knew with Poopery was I knew how to build a brand. I knew that the brand had a voice, a style, a look, a, you know, an experience. When you get the Supernatural box, everything about it's stunning. And that's what I knew. I knew what qualities need to build a brand. So I learned that through wisdom. I didn't have to learn the hard way. And then another thing, I knew not to stop at good. That's why I spent so much money and so much time. It had to be like literally knock your socks off. And I'll tell you, like 98% of people love Supernatural. Some people don't like all oils. That's at 2%. Because, you know, I'm in there going, who are those 2%? What's happening? And our repeat purchase is insane, like way, like 10 times what the average is to the market, because it really is that special.
That's amazing. Was there anything unexpected the second time around?
So what I did differently is Supernatural is direct to consumer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a huge fan of retail. I do believe that our future is going towards everyone buying at home. And it's interesting to see what's happening with retail. So I was determined that I not go into retail outlets and we just sell direct to consumer. So that was different.
Yes.
Because believe it or not, our direct to consumer business is a small part of Poopery's business. It's less than 10%. So that was a completely different business. And it's really been fun to learn about customer acquisition and, you know,
it's a different beast.
It's a whole different piece. So that was a whole new world that I feel excited about.
So obviously we're in the middle of some really interesting times right now, and I'm wondering how the current climate with people staying at home and the global pandemic are affecting both brands and how you're adapting.
I'll tell you, man, we were hit so hard. Supernatural wasn't hit hard because we're direct to consumer and people are cleaning more. So that was lovely. So that brand has had a, you know, increase. Mm-hmm. But Poopery, we were hit really hard our first quarter, and that we had a double digit millions of dollars order that was canceled from one of our big stores. Yeah. So imagine having that hit. And then all of a sudden, lots of retail started canceling their POs, and it looked like a house of cards. You know, it was pretty scary. And I just had surgery here in LA. And I heard that hand sanitizer was in short supply. And I text my executive team and I said, how quickly can we get in the hand sanitizer business? And we did. And we've sold millions of bottles to date. It really helped us. Now we're looking at branching out. Who knew you could sell Poopery hand sanitizer? People love it. It's a natural product. It's lavender and coconut. So what has really been good is we're making up for that lost business, but we're also shifting our direct-to-consumer businesses up, like I think 400%.
Wow.
So, and also our e-com. So I immediately brought in a rock star e-com team and direct-to-consumer team. And I mean, they're killing it. And now I got to tell you, I'm rethinking business. I mean, it's amazing how much you can do with so much less resources.
It's crazy. It's really crazy.
Yeah.
So one of the things we like to talk about on this podcast is mistakes, because everyone makes them and not everyone wants to own up to it. And I feel like people present things in this like Instagram perfect world, like we've never made a misstep or had any difficulty in any way. And that's just not true. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about a misstep or a mistake that you've made in your career and what you've learned from it.
Yeah, let's see. Which one do we want to talk about? A couple of years ago, everyone wanted an automatic unit, like a poopery that sprays on its own. And we decided to do it. And someone ripped me off and was trying to get to market faster. And we were in such struggle with this product that, I mean, really, we weren't going to get it out the door. I got really scared and started pushing to get this thing made, to try to beat someone to market, which is against everything I believe in. It's against what I teach, but I did it anyway. And I ended up losing millions of dollars because we had to recall all the units, what they got here. It was really, I mean, it was quite a few $1 million, you know, experience. And when I look back, it's really just confirmation of what I know inside. And that's to really not push through things. That when things are in struggle, to like stop and step back and see what's going on and not be motivated by fear. So that's what I've learned even more. I remember talking to my mentor after that, and I'm like, oh my God, I just lost millions of dollars on this deal. And he's like, some of my biggest lessons have cost me a lot of money. I'm like, yeah, you know.
It's always interesting when we go against what we know we should do. And there's just this human aspect where you can't help yourself. Like, there are those moments where you're like, I know better, but I can't, I'm going to go for it anyway.
Well, it's because we're afraid. Like that, I was afraid competition. And you know what, those people, I don't even know where they're at. This is what's funny. Everything I've ever thought of in business that, you know, was scary, I can't even tell you what it was. all the competition that was going to take me out are gone, right?
It's right. Like, yeah.
But at the time, it's so freaking real and scary.
So real. So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are often in their first life in their career, some way or another. They have maybe a side project, or they're interested in transitioning industries, but they're not quite sure how to go about it. As someone who seems quite fearless in this department, what advice would you give someone who wants to switch lanes in some way or another, but is having a little bit of trouble making that leap?
Well, I would look at our world right now, and we are in such ambiguous, uncertain times. But I think right now should give you a real wake-up call to kind of go, what am I doing? And also, I would really suggest that you really understand the weight and impact that you being in a dissonant situation is. So I teach a lot about resonance and dissonance. And resonance is when you put two energy waves together, those two together traveling same speed and energy create more energy together than they do apart. Okay. Dissonance is two energy waves are traveling at different speeds and it actually cancels out and you have less energy than if you weren't in that situation. So I would look at if you're in a dissonant situation, notice your energy level at the end of the day. Do you feel excited? Do you feel tired? If you feel tired, then realize that you literally are reducing your life force energy. Like that's true. It's proven. It's scientific. And you need to make a move for your life force energy. There's no amount of money. People talk about security. Right now we should know. We don't know what's going to happen. What are you talking about security? Where's security? So really get real with the face of where we're at and look at the impact that of your current situation. What is that having on you energetically? And I often say if energy were our new currency, like how rich would you be?
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah. So look at your energetic state. And then when you do that, if you start dropping the stuff that's weighing you down, you can start putting in stuff that actually turns you on because you have room and space for it. So I'm a big advocate. If you don't like what you're doing, honey, go. Like, get it. Just go. Because the worst thing you're going to do is fail. And Lord knows how many times I failed. It seems to, I'm still here.
So Susie, my last question is also my favorite question, which is if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self and give her some advice, what would you say?
You know, it's really funny. I answer this question differently all the time. But what I just got just now from telling you earlier about fear is to realize that, you know, there's so many things that seem so terrifying in the moment that when you really look back at it, you're not going to remember in a few years. you know, it's really just an energetic state that you can go crazy in your mind. And the reality is, it's probably never going to happen. So just realize that. Realize that thing you're terrified of probably is not going to happen. So minimize that fear in your mind and just keep trucking, you know?
I love that. That was the founder and CEO of Poopery and Supernatural, Susie Batise. For more inspiring interviews with women like Susie, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. We love, love, love seeing you spread the word on social, and you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so if you have a great idea, send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.